Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to the Motor Mouth Podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between.
We've partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, helping to raise awareness and help find a cure. Thanks to our partnership, we've been able to create a short series of special podcasts uncovering those within the motorsport community who've been affected by these devastating diagnoses. You can hear those stories, including the Williams F1 team's planning director, Richard Jones, right now on your chosen podcast player. Also, bookings are still available for the Motormouth charity karting event with places on August the 10th still on general sale. Enter your team of four to an endurance race and compete with and against a host of motorsport celebs or pro drivers who will be drawn at random to be on your team. Gates open at 12:30 and close at 6 p.m. For all the information and to see who you could be up against, head to motormouthkartrace.com. We'll see you there, and together we can help every single person affected by a brain tumour. It's season 8 and we're really excited to be once again teaming up with F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel programme of Formula 1. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the pinnacle of motorsport. And let's face it, any chance to get close to Formula 1 this year, we are all over it. And the brilliant news is you can now return trackside thanks to F1 Experiences. Enjoy the very best race tickets and track hospitality, first-class hotel, and unprecedented access you simply cannot get anywhere else. For more information on how you can book your F1 experience, visit f1experiences.com, where you can also save 5% on your very own F1 Experiences package by using the code MOTORMOUTH when checking out online. So, what are you waiting for? Experience the 2021 F1 season firsthand with exclusive access courtesy of F1 Experiences. Get booking today at f1experiences.com.
Hello everyone, Tim Sylvie here. Now, today's guest was born in County Durham before spending his formative years in Wales. But did you know that County Durham is the very place where Britain's tallest man was born, standing a remarkable 7 feet 7 inches? He went on to play Mag the Great in the TV series Game of Thrones. Never seen it, so I couldn't tell you who that is. Sadly, he died in February 2007. But it is also home to English mustard, which came into existence when in the early 1900s, Mrs. Clements decided to grind up mustard seeds in order to get more flavour out of them. She developed a paste from the process that quickly became popular all over the UK. And after being passed down to her daughter, the family business was eventually sold to the Colemans of Norwich. I bet you didn't know that, Harry Benjamin.
I did not. Imagine being that person to discover mustard. Yeah. Like, that's kind of, it's quite, I mean, I imagine she made quite a lot of money from that, but it's kind of mad, isn't it?
Do you like mustard?
No, I hate it.
Really?
I mean, I would never go out of my way to have it have it, but sometimes it can end up in a sandwich. But I would never go out of my way to have it in my diet.
Oh, I love a bit of mustard. What have you been up to? What's new?
Well, I just got back from Hungary doing some more GT racing, which is fun, and Euro F3 stuff. And then I got a puppy on the way back. So I've got a new puppy, or my dad's got a puppy, more accurately to say. But I'm, of course, surrounding it and looking after it while it's in its infancy.
Very nice.
He's adorable and pisses on the floor, but hey. Got to make use of it.
Absolutely. Well, shall I introduce today's guest?
I think so.
So today we're joined by another of the MB Partners stable run by Mark Blundell in the form of Jan Mardenborough, whose career really took off in 2011 when he won Nissan PlayStation's GT Academy competition when they went on to compete in British GT, the massively competitive Blancpain GT Endurance Cup, Le Mans 24 Hours, Formula 3, GP2, Super GT, Super Formula, Formula E, a sim and development driver. Jan Mardenborough, welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
Hello, guys. Hi, Tim. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Jan. Very warm welcome to you. Great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on. Where are you at the moment? You're in your garden. You've got a nice blue sky in the background. You're in the UK.
Yeah, I'm in my hometown. Well, in Wales. Not my hometown, but I've lived in Madrid my life. And just in the garden because it's sunny for once.
Very nice. Looks very relaxing. Looks like you're on holiday. But now for the important stuff, though. Now, your route, as Tim alluded to, to Motorsport, is not typical.
Oh, hello.
We're joined by a very special guest.
That's not your... Whose dog is that? Is that your dog?
Yeah, it's my dog. Heidi.
Heidi, down.
Come here.
Blair. What kind of dog is it?
It's a... she's a Goldador.
A Goldador?
What is
this? So a mix between a Labrador and a Golden Retriever. And she's about 7 months now.
Oh, wow. So
she's at the age where it's, well, she's not a puppy anymore, but she's still.
She's still, very much a slight one. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Well, I'm sure we're here for Heidi throughout the show. But your route into motorsport, as Tim alluded to, it was not typical, really, compared to the other guests that we've had on our show, you know, who came up through the sort of the traditional karting system. You had a very different approach and a very different break when it came to your career. And we will come on to that soon, of course, first. But take us back to your much younger years before all that. Was motorsport and racing always a bit of a thing for you? When did it sort of first hit you and go, actually, yeah, I kind of want to get into this racing world?
9 years old. So cars were my first interest in anything as a kid. So I don't know, like age 4, matchbox cars and stuff. And then I think around like age 9, kind of motorsport on TV and racing games kind of came at the same time. So I was playing Gran Turismo and Colin McRae and at the same time watching British touring cars. And then ever since then, it was like, oh, wow, I would love to do that. I watched it all the time. Every time it was on the weekend, I was watching British touring cars. So that era, so from that early age, it was like, I want to be able to do that when I'm older.
And you're essentially regarded as the original gamer to racer, beating 90,000 other people to win the GT Academy in 2011, which was run by Nissan and Gran Turismo. When you entered that competition, were you thinking, I've got a chance here, or was it just, I'm going to do this for fun, see what happens? Could you imagine what was going to happen afterwards?
It was secondary of your point there. It was like just to see how far I can go. So at the time I was on a gap year from uni. It was like an unplanned time off. And then it was like, okay, I'm just going to see how far I can go with this. And it was only up until like the last event of the final at Silverstone where I thought, okay, now I've got a chance. But before that, it was like, okay, things are going well. I'm just going to keep going, see what's happening. And I'm actually all right. And then it just kind of happened. But I was a completely like one of those racehorses where it's just completely blinkered.
Yeah.
It was weird. It was a weird situation and a weird vibe I was in. It was like, I don't care what happens externally. It's just like, whatever I'm doing now, that is the 100% focus. And
it's funny.
Very strange time.
It's funny as well, because now it's kind of not unusual for someone to maybe be a star in gaming and then make the move across to real racing, or, you know, gaming is very much at the forefront at the moment. But I suppose in 2011, it was pretty unusual, and this was one of the first times it had ever been done. Did you have any idea how big this was all going to become, this whole esports industry, especially related to sim racing?
No, I didn't. I knew of esports from around that time of 11, because my friends used to play like World of Warcraft and League of Legends, that kind of stuff. It never interested me at all, but I knew from conversations with them, there was always like big events going on in Korea where people are earning like $500,000 prize funds and stuff, which I thought was mad. But I never thought, I didn't have the vision that this could kind of, at that time anyway, in 2011, where it could kind of get to the point where it is now, where it's huge now, especially when you bring YouTubers into it, where, yeah, as you say, it's not so unusual to see guys that come from gaming make it, well, try their hand anyway in motorsports. So one example is Jimmy Broadbent. Like, he's now in Praga in Britcar. Whereas it's not normal, but it's like, it's more of it happening. Whereas in 2011, to have a major manufacturer like Nissan and Sony, just imagine the health and safety checklist that they'd have to go through.
Yeah.
You know, oh, let's go put a gamer in a car just to see what happens. It was very out there.
Yeah. Well, clearly for you though, it paid off. But I'm also curious, because it was, you know, 2011, and we see the games now, and I think the F1 2021 is about to be released, and it's so realistic. You could have proper huge setups where, you know, if you're obviously full on, you can have, you know, full rigs, and you really get the sense of the full feeling of what a real car is like. But back then, was the technology there enough for you, for that transition for you to make from gaming to real life racing? Or, you know, was it still very, you know, compared to now, I imagine it can't have been as realistic, or maybe it was?
Obviously the technology is better now. The rig that I have at home now is infinitely better than the one I had at the time. The technology was there because I did it. And there's people that had done it before around the same time as well. So, and you make the best of what you've got. Certainly I didn't have a PC at the time. It was just Gran Turismo 5 and my Fanatec wheel that I had. And I didn't do any karting or anything like that. So what I learned, how to drive and how to racecraft and all that, was just on that. So yeah, it's certainly possible, but, now the technology, I don't think it's like linear, the way that the technology gets better and that in turn it becomes easier to make the transition. I don't think it's like a linear, it's not linear. I think there is a point where it gets better and better and better, to a point, because you don't fundamentally have the vibration, through your backside. You don't have that. So until that happens, I don't think it gets any easier having better technology, better software and better simulators, better wheels, better pedals. It helps, but it's not linear.
And actually, just off from that as well, do you think that, we've spoken about this before, I think, with, it might have been Rob Smedley, who was Felipe Massa's F1 engineer, and he's now starting this sort of electric go-karting scheme for young, obviously, racers. Do you ever think that people who can't, because obviously karting is so expensive now, you know, the whole junior ladder is, it's always been expensive, but it just goes up and up each year, it seems. Do you think that actually it could become a viable route, actually, where young racers who want to go karting can't afford it, actually turn to esports, and at least in the early days of their career, and try and build up almost, you know, that what comes with that in terms of the social following and the presence, and then actually with all these opportunities that are now on the rise with esports, do you think that's a viable alternative to starting out in karts at 4 years old?
I think it is a viable alternative, but I don't believe that it can completely replace karting, because being in a kart in that environment where you are competing with other people, and the brutalness, and it's very a violent sport, especially in karting, and to have like other people around you and you're in a race, it's different. So you can't replace it completely. I mean, certainly, as you said, if you build up a following, a huge social media, because that's needed now, for your image, your brand, and then you decide to jump into, I don't know, a junior level of motorsports, certainly that helps, but you should not disregard karting. Include karting.
Yeah.
Include karting, because you learn so much, so much. I don't think you can, if there's someone who's young and they just do kart, let's say a Formula 3 or Formula 4 car, compared to the person that Tim is amazing at sim, and then an F3 car, the guy that does karting is going to still be quitting the guy that's just jumped in the Formula 3 car by just doing the sim. When I think back now, I'm surprised how, not easy, but it was kind of seamless jumping into the, like a 370Z GT4 car and just getting up to its limit fairly quickly. I was surprised about that. I certainly think being young helped as well, because I was 19, just turned 20. So I had no fear at all. No self-preservation, well, little self-preservation.
Yeah.
And just had an eagerness just to learn and impress as well and just improve myself. So those early races, they went great, apart from one incident in Zandvoort, which my mechanics at the time at RGN would never, ever let me forget about it. And certainly Bob Neville would never let me forget either. Up until that point, that was just before, a few races before Dubai. It was smooth, I was improving, but I was always aware that it could end at any moment. My mentors as well, Rob and Christian, were always telling me, look, it could end tomorrow, you know, for whatever reason, this hand can pull the plug. So it was like, I was, again, like a horse, blinked horse. It was like, I need to improve and show these guys that I'm worthy of this seat, of this potential, because I didn't know what's going to happen after Dubai. That was meant to be it. Your prize done there. Mm. Bye-bye. Nice to meet you. Ciao.
have a good life. Yeah.
Yeah. Like back then I didn't think about what could happen after Dubai, because I didn't want to, because it was scary, because it's like, I didn't want it to stop. But fortunately, I can't remember if it was before, I think it was after Dubai, At the after party that we had, that I got told that next year is, well, the following year is okay, but we can't tell you yet what was going to happen. And that was sick. It was awesome, yeah. Really awesome.
Having that backing of Nissan, just it was all about just getting more and more track time, basically, for you to continue your improvement.
Yeah. So 2012 was, looking back now, it was even more special than I realized at the time, because that was the first year that Nissan introduced the new GT3 car, the GTR. And our car that we were running was the first in Europe. So that car was the only car running in Europe at the time. So we were doing British GT and a few rounds of the Blancpain Endurance. So I think we did Monza, Nürburgring, Spa, and I think maybe one other one. But just to be driving that car, so a step up into GT3, and it was the first car in Europe. I mean, it was so cool. I think we definitely had the first podium in Europe of that car. I don't know about if overall, because I think it maybe got a podium in Japan before us, first win. But it was a dope championship. British GT was great. We were fighting up until the last round for the championship with Alex Buncombe. And then in Blancpain, we were a bit more unlucky because the car had a bit more issue. It was just teething issues. So at Spa, the car broke down very early on at Spa, which is the most, you know, when you do a 24-hour race, and especially before it gets dark, and then you break down or something happens, and then you go back to your hotel and all the cars are still running.
Oh.
It's the most sad thing in the world, man. Like, it sucks. But overall, it was a great year. It was really good fun, especially in that car, because it was new and it was still had its development wasn't quite well developed to where it is now anyway. But it was still known as like being an absolute missile down the straights. Mm. Like in other areas where it wasn't so strong, he was good on the brakes, but downforce wise, it wasn't great. Traction was terrible. It was so, had so much turbo lag as well. But on the straights, it was a weapon, absolute weapon. It was like almost embarrassing how quick that early GTR was in GT3.
Amazing. I mean, what an experience as well. And it's always a pleasure to welcome Tim back to the podcast.
My Wi-Fi historically has been absolutely bang on.
Yeah.
And today it's not. So good luck editing this one, Harry. It's going to be a fun one. But where are we up to? 2013?
So, yeah, do you want to talk about Le Mans?
Let's do Le Mans. So, 2013, you compete in Le Mans, one of the greatest races on the planet, and you achieved third in LMP2. It's a crazy race. How did you find dealing with such a prolonged period of racing day and night, all the emotions and tiredness that goes along with it? How did you find it?
The most difficult part of that whole weekend was the build up to it, because it's, you arrive there for the test day, which is like a week before, and then you're still at Le Mans for the whole week after. And the build-up starts on like, I think the Tuesday, and you're doing everything every single day. The first few days of you're doing nothing Tuesday, Wednesday, then it starts ramping up very quickly. And if you don't plan your sleep or your time and your energy, by the time it comes race day, you're already fucked. Like I was fucked for race day. Like there was so much going on. It was, are you the first gamer or second gamer at Le Mans and all this stuff? And it was like, oh, there's so much going on. And then in the race, it was my second 24-hour race, second or third 24-hour race. It happened to be Le Mans, and I took the start, which wasn't planned, because our great engineer, Ricardo de Villa, God bless his soul, he made a bit of an error. So in Le Mans back then, whoever set the fastest time in qualifying has to start the race. And in qualifying, my original run didn't go to plan because I got traffic or whatever, the usual excuses. Then I think Lucas or Michael Crum did the qualifying and then went quicker. And then they decided to put me in at the end in the night qualifying. Nobody really goes quicker in the night quali because it's in the dark. Then I managed to go quicker and they didn't expect that. So they cocked up because they were like, look, the gamer guy, he's going to be starting the race at the mall because he set the fastest time of the car. I was gassed. I was like, yo, I'm starting the race at the mall. This is going to be cool. But it was mega, yeah. So everybody else was flapping. I was like, this is calm. This is going to be good fun.
Did you get any... Or not just at Le Mans, but throughout your career, have you ever had people being like, who does this guy think he is? He plays a computer game. He comes in here, thinks he can race. Have you experienced any of that?
Yeah, my first ever weekend at Pembrey in the Welsh Classic Sports and Saloon Car Championship, I think it's called.
Oh, right.
It's like a club level race where I had, you know, you get your signatures the first few races. I was in a 370Z, and there was the last year's champion basically came up to me and he was like, oh, I've heard of this because of the previous winners coming down and doing the same race the year before. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he goes, if you see me in your mirrors, don't fight me, just let me go.
What a
and
deal.
Like, I was like, yo, fuck you. Like, there's no way. And I ended up beating him. But that's the only time I've experienced it to my face. I don't know, behind the scenes, I have no idea. But that was the only time I've ever experienced it to my face. It was funny. It was good. I still remember it vividly. It was
Name and shame.
Yeah. From the Welsh days. What a twat.
Yeah.
The way around.
In my head, I was like, yeah, you are something else.
I think you probably showed him enough that you're probably pretty decent as a real world racing driver anyway. And enough so that obviously you're racing in GTs with a roof over your head.
A quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, F1 Experiences. F1 Experiences offer a wide range of packages that come direct from Formula One, giving you a unique experience experience of the pinnacle of motorsport. Official ticket packages come with the very best race tickets, first-class hotels and transfers, and unprecedented access, including track tours, pit lane walks, VIP hospitality, and loads more. It really is the closest you can get to Formula One, and thanks to F1 Experiences, you can return to the track this year, and Motormouth listeners can save 5% on your next F1 Experiences package by using the code Motormouth when booking online at f1experiences.com.
And then comes the move the following year to single seaters, and you're now sort of, you find yourself in GP3, what is now Formula 3, and you take a win in only your eighth start, I think it was, at the Hockenheimring in the sprint race. That must have been, again, crazy, because, you know, you're looking back at the last 3 years and thinking, God, I've gone from playing a video game backed by Nissan to being a Nissan driver with a roof on my head racing endurance racing, and now I'm only a couple of rungs below Formula One. What is happening?
Yeah, it was. I didn't expect to take the single seater route at all. It was only when the conversation happened where Alex Buncombe's dad, Jonathan Buncombe, had a conversation with some of the guys at the BRDC to say, Jan looks like he should be in single seaters. And then that kind of went to Darren Cox, who runs the GT Academy program. And then he was like, huh, maybe we should put him in F3 or try him in an F2 car. Then it was F3. And then the GP3 came about. I didn't expect it to happen at all because, you know, Nissan is in GT cars, not Formula cars. But I'm so grateful it happened, because your learning development as a driver increases so much with cars with proper downforce. So I'm a much more rounded, faster driver taking both routes. If I was to do it again, and Darren and all the guys at GT Academy know this as well, you would change, you'd do the opposite. You'd put them in single seaters first and then put them in GT, because I was the guy to first trial this out. And because of the GT experience that I've driven, especially in the GT3 GTR, where it's not the most elegant way to drive that car, jumping in an F3 car where it's all so delicate, it took me ages to change the mind of the driving style. It took me a long time. So yeah, if we ever did it again, it would be like, look, single seats first, and then you could do the GTs as well, alongside.
But
it's a cool experience.
It's definitely it's a bit arse about face, isn't it? I think the only other person that jumps to mind who's done it the same way is Jamie Chadwick, because she obviously started out in GTs and made the switch to British F3. It was hard for her. It took her a long time to get to grips with it. So yeah, I totally agree. It should be the other way around. And then just skipping forward a little bit, it's funny, we talked about this program with one of our previous guests very recently, the slightly doomed Nissan LMP1 program. We know a few people that have taken part in it, and, you know, mixed sort of reports on it, really. Some like, you know, well, it was a bit of a experimental exercise, could have been fantastic, wasn't, but, you know, it was a great thing to be a part of. How do you look back at that interesting time with that very unique car?
It's an environment which if I was ever in a situation like that again, you would know quicker if it is going to plan or not. Fundamentally, the car was not given enough time, and that is due to internal political things, which is ever the bane of sport and life, I guess. But it wasn't given enough time. If that car had another year development, it would have been a lot different.
Yeah.
The thing that really killed the car off was the moment where, I mean, I can name people now because, like, it was that is fact. That's what happened. So there was this company, who I think Torotech, can't remember exactly, but anyway, they produced these flywheels, which is what the LMP1 car had on the front of its gearbox, which was meant to be our hybrid. So that was used to slow down the car. So it was all designed when we hit the brake, when we lift off, that thing would, can't remember exactly how it happened, but that was our brakes of the car. The main, like over 50%, probably even more than that, the brakes off the car, then the energy stored up in that flywheel would then be deployed to the rear wheel. So before wheel drive. In testing, about 2 months before some time closer to Le Mans, maybe 3 months before, this company, we were testing it on the car, Marc Genet was testing it, and it wasn't working. And this company were like, oh, well, it works on our buses. And the problem was the G-force in the corners, the pumps that they designed couldn't scavenge enough oil for it to work all the time. So Genet was breaking into a corner. He's at Sebring. He was breaking into a corner and it would turn off.
Right.
So like it was the bulk of the braking. So he's mid brake zone and the thing decides to shut off. He goes off the track. Like, how can you drive a race car where suddenly your braking zone is extended by 15 meters because the thing decides to shut off? At that moment, the project was pretty much doomed if it wasn't given another year, because you can't design a car that was originally designed with this flywheel and then it not be there. So you have to redesign the brakes, which didn't stop up until the Le Mans test day. We were still trying different brake material on the Le Mans test day. Our pit lane was the end of the pit lane. And you know how long the Le Mans pit lane is. Our car was coming through the pit lane and the brakes were still glowing in daylight by the time they got to the end of the pit lane.
Yeah, that's
how much of an issue that we had. So it all stemmed to this hybrid not working because the team was lied to by this company that they said it was going to work on the car and it wasn't working. So at that point, it was doomed. So it needed another year of development. And that didn't happen because of other reasons that I don't know exactly. But it's a shame, really, because the guys behind it, they were real visionaries. Some of the design elements of that LMP1 car are still being used to this day now with other teams. So, I mean, if you sit at the back of that car, you could see directly from to the front of it. It had these two huge channels either side of the tub. The bonnet, for example, was very long, and the reason for that is to have a more forward center of aero pressure, so the car generated much more front downforce with that slight design. Even the rear clamshell, some design cues still look very similar to, say, the Toyota a few years ago. The engine was amazing. It was very, very strong, that engine. It was just a shame that it was killed before it was like a stillborn. That's a pretty crude way to put it, but it was
a
bit like that.
I think we spoke to Harry Tinknell, who said, you know, obviously he was quite involved in that project as well. He said, you know, it's just a case of what could have been. You know, it could have really been something special, and just to be a part of it was a privilege, I suppose. At the same time, working on something so different and so new, which just unfortunately didn't quite have the outcome that you all wanted.
Yeah, I mean, just the experience of being involved in that team, you learn so much. There was so many things that were different of that car, the obvious being front wheel drive, but you how to work through problems as well, because there was many. That experience is invaluable.
No, it's a real shame it didn't work out. Like you say, there's some good people involved, so real pity. But then after that, you made a very big move all the way to the other side of the world. You went to Japan. How did this come about? Obviously, it's got to be Nissan connected. And importantly, do you speak Japanese?
So, yes, I speak a little bit of Japanese. I'm studying at home now.
Very admirable.
Yeah, because I have goals to get back out. Well, it is the goal to get back out there. And so, I mean, it's not, don't take it the wrong way. Like, it's very small, but I'm working towards it. And Japan, going out there was because of what happened in 2015 with Le Mans. Nissan in Europe was pretty much, the situation wasn't good. So the racing, the money that was putting into Nissan Europe for the European racing was drying up. So, GT Academy at the time, they were like, look, we think you should go and race in Japan, move to Japan. Because Europe, if you want to make a career, getting into GP2 again, finding that money to do that,
it
looks unlikely. Whereas if you go into their back Japanese backyard and work your way up the ladder again, you can have a career over there. And, you know, I'm still, I love Nissan, and, you know, I want to, I've always watched Super GT as well. I've watched that in the past. I was like, this is a cool championship. So the goal was, okay, yeah, I would like a GT 500 seat. But in Japan, they don't care where you come from, what your credentials are, bar F1. If you're an F1 driver, you're God. In any championship, you walk straight in and you get a seat a lot of the time. But if you're, you know, been great in Europe and other parts of the world, doesn't matter in Japan. Like, you start at ground zero. You start in Formula 3.
Yeah.
You start working your way up through GT 300. And then you have an audition, and then you can maybe get a GT 500 seat and be a factory driver. And I like that because it's, you got to prove to them like who you, your name.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I literally went back a step. So I'd done GP, I did one race GP2. So I wouldn't say I was in GP2, but I did GP3. Certainly it's a higher level than F3. But they were like, okay, we want you to do F3 for a year. And then GT3 in the Super GT Championship as well. So I was doing two championships in 16, almost won F3. I'll leave it at that because I'm going to say some stuff which I'll probably regret later on. But that was awesome.
Yeah, no, but Japanese F3 is not to be sniffed at. I mean, in fact, the whole Japanese system is pretty impressive. Mm. I mean, you got and they make people, they put them on a pedestal out there. Like Andre Lotterer, when he was racing out there, was like he was godly. You know, people absolutely loved him. Marcus Ericsson's come from there. Nick Cassidy, it was a proving ground for him. As a young guy called Stuart Moore.
Michael Schumacher, way back when, and Ralph Schumacher, they both did Japanese. The formula, didn't they?
Good knowledge. Struan Moore, who still races a little bit, he was out there doing Japanese F3, and he did pretty well, not amazingly well, but the Japanese fans adored him, like loved him. There were little Struan Moore dolls. It was insane. It's a good championship out there, and you can make forge a very good career for yourself. And you, like you say, you did very well Japanese F3 with 12 podiums, 4 wins. Did you enjoy it out there? Do you enjoy the culture, the lifestyle, the way they go about their racing?
I love it out there. I love the championship. I think Super GT is the best run championship I've ever been in. The culture is very different to Western style, but once you learn the rules and also the unwritten rules, you can get by and integrate yourself into their culture and understand how things work over there. And it's true, like if you do well over there, you are treated very well. They're loyal to you. So I want to go back out there. I would love to spend my whole career in Japan.
Wow.
Racing over there in Super GT. Yeah, I love it. It's ever since there's been 3 places I wanted to go to as a kid. It was America, Dubai, and Tokyo. It was just Tokyo, just because of watching films.
Yeah.
And to be able to race in all 3, and then to race in Japan, all over Japan. Yeah, it's the best place. My favorite place on earth
it's a beautiful country.
That country.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Just wanted to pick up though as well. Obviously, you've got GT blood running through your veins, but you've also done Super Formula, which a lot of people might be familiar with, is sort of the top level of single seat racing in Japan, you know, almost like the Formula One, but in Japan. What was that like as well? But clearly, is that not where your focuses are driven either? Because I suppose, are they on an equal footing in terms of Super Formula and Super GT, or is one above the other?
No, it's seen, it's like, I guess LMP1 to Formula One. It's like it's completely separate tiered, you know. A lot of the guys that do Super GT are also racing in Super Formula. Okay. A lot of the Honda guys and the Toyota, because obviously in Super Formula the engines are Honda and Toyota. Unfortunately, Nissan doesn't have an engine in Super Formula. They used to way back, but now they don't. So a lot of the guys that do GT are doing that championship as well. Doing Super Formula was again a massive privilege. Those cars are insane. I remember doing Formula 3 and Super Formula used to race sometimes on the same weekend. So our races were finished before the Super Formula main event. And you just go on the grid just to see these cars and they're just fat tires, massive low rear wing. They look like the cars, the F1 cars from like 2007, you know, just wide, aggressive looking things. They got so much downforce. Doing it, you know, you learn a lot. And that championship was, for me, it was a tough year. There were some real good races where I had a lot of speed. But if I was to do it again, you know, that championship is all about the little tiny nuanced things you do behind the scenes. And knowing what I know now, it would be completely different. So just to give you a little example, and this is also my fault because I'm a person from a Western country in their country, and I didn't at the time speak good Japanese. So my engineer was Japanese. His English was non-existent. So I was talking to my engineer through my teammate in Super GT, Kazuki Hoshino, who knew English, who then translated to my engineer, and then my engineer would tell Kazuki in Japanese something, and then he would translate it to me. We'd do that in the race. And of course, that's never going to be the most ideal situation. Yeah. But again, that's not a fault of them at all. But knowing that if I was going to a championship like that again, knowing if that was the same situation, it'd be like, no, look, we need to do something different. Mm. But it was cool. It was a cool experience. Unfortunately, 1 year, but I got pole at Suzuka on my last ever race, which was nice.
I just wonder whether in that process of translating from teammate to engineer to teammate back down again, whether anything was lost in translation, you know, the odd thing not passed through that perhaps should have been.
Yeah, there was probably some things that were not quite exactly how I meant them to be said. Yeah. But if it was anything, you know, bad, no, that wouldn't have happened because the guy that was translating, Kazuki Hoshino, he's like one of my best mates. He's like the most, like top three teammates I've ever had. And he always got my back. I've always got his. Yeah, top man.
Good stuff. Well, listen, there's plenty of other bits we can talk about, but in the interest of time, we're going to skip ahead to our final three. And we ask these questions to everybody that comes on the show.
I want to, I said I was learning some Japanese. You asked me a question. Have I learned any Japanese?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I have a lot. I can say some stuff. So, okay, let me just say, watashi wa yanmarume desu, niju kusai desu, reisu desu, yoroshiku arigashimasu. So that's basically, I'm Jan Mardenbrough. I'm 29 years old. I'm a racer. Pleased to meet you.
Oh, wow. Yoroshiku arigashimasu.
What does that mean?
that actually means something. I can't remember what. I've got a Japanese mate, Taka, who mushy mushy. Isn't that when you pick up the phone, you go mushy mushy? I know little bits and pieces.
Moshi mom.
Yeah.
How do you learn it? Are you like is Duolingo or is it was something a bit more advanced than that? Or how are you learning Japanese?
At home, there's a. A similar to Duolingo, I think it's called iTalki.
Okay.
iTalki talking, and they have online tutors. So, I mean, the last lesson I had was about 5 weeks ago. But I was talking to a Japanese lady.
Oh, cool!
Who's fluent in English and German, and we'd have like an hour lesson just to. It just has a syllabus, so...
It sounds... I'm kind of jealous. I tried to learn French earlier at the start of lockdown, and I think I did one Duolingo lesson and never went back, so I don't have the determination. But it's very embarrassing when you go to another country and you just can't speak. It's terrible. But Japanese, it's probably quite integral, especially with the engineer side of things as well. Otherwise, you're gonna be missing out on things, aren't you? Mm. But... Jan, look, it's been absolutely fascinating getting to know you and getting to know a bit more about you as well. And there is stuff, as Tim alluded to, that we've sort of skipped over it, but in the interest of time, we do have our final three questions, which, as Tim has said, we asked to all of our guests. It's just nice to see the variation in answer. So, Tim, do you want to kick off?
Yes, indeed. Jan, what has you excited at this very moment, apart from investing in new Wi-Fi?
Bitcoin.
Yes.
Ooh.
Oh, now we can talk. We can talk. Right.
Yeah. I can talk Bitcoin for hours, you know.
Okay. What you got? So I've got Ethereum and a little bit of Litecoin and a minuscule piece of Bitcoin, like 0.0027 Bitcoin, which at the moment is tanking. Like, it's my whole portfolio is completely fallen through the floor. What are you into?
Just Bitcoin. I have a little splattering of like 1% in other, but that's just a little speculative thing. The majority of everything, 99%, is just in Bitcoin. And the reason I've been in this for like 5 years now, and it's I understand it and why it's created and the reason why it's doing what it's doing currently. My other interest in apart from racing, photography is financial, economy, how things work. And without sounding too tinfoil hat, conspiracy theorist, crazy person, it's pretty much rigged against you. You can't save your way to having a, say, generational wealth unless you have many investments in or land or housing or property and stuff. Whereas, Bitcoin, it's, you trust code,
yeah,
and it's immutable. So
it's an interesting subject. So it's one that I'm relatively deep into in terms of knowledge, not in terms of the amount of Bitcoin or crypto that I own, but I find the whole subject fascinating. And I've recently got into non-fungible tokens and fan tokens, which have found their way into motorsport with McLaren and others. It's a hugely fascinating subject. I can feel a Bitcoin special with Jan Mardenborough coming on.
I'm keen. That'll be dope.
I'm all over it.
I had a proper discussion about this with Jordan King the other week as well.
Ooh, yeah.
So he's got a bit of Bitcoin and a bit of all these other stuff going on. So I think we could probably get a few people together and have a good old good chat about it.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Who's invested in what? So we're building up a list now. So we've got Jan, Jordan King. We'll find a few more and then we'll get you all together.
But it is literally one of those things that you would happily get together and just talk about. Because it's such an interesting subject. So genuinely mean it. Well, actually, we've got... I don't know if the guys at MB Partners spoke to you about the 10th of August, Jan. We've got our karting day. If not, we'll talk about it offline. But that could be our opportunity to natter about Bitcoin. okay, good. I like that answer. We've not had that on before. Harry, over to you for question number two.
Yes, question number two. Jan, if not doing what you're doing, which was being a pro racing driver, what would you be doing? What would you have done?
I would be most likely designing furniture for DFS or something like that.
Was not expecting that.
Wow.
Yeah, it was when I went to uni in 2010. Oh, sorry, when I reapplied to go to university in the year of GT Academy 2011, I was accepted on a furniture design course. It was probably along those lines. Like, it's scary how I'm not doing that because it sounds shit.
Well, at DFS, there's always a deal on, isn't there, for those? So, don't know how they make any money. Wow. How crazy is it how one small thing can change the outcome of what your path in life is quite incredible, isn't it? Yeah. Tim, you've got the last one, haven't you?
I do indeed. What are you scared of?
Losing my speed.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay.
Nice.
Can that happen? Like, is that something racing drivers, that can happen to a racing driver? Is that something that can actually feasibly happen? I suppose it's getting older, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You can see it with some drivers. Let's say Vettel. He's not the same guy was 5 years ago. He's just not. He's I think he maybe lost a little bit of his speed, but the racecraft is like, it's gone, man. Like, it's not there. Like, the amount of times he's spun in the last 3 years,
it's not how he was before.
I mean, there's a video on YouTube which I watched when I first started racing, and I've just remembered it because it's amazing. That he's racing Hamilton when they're in F3, you're F3, and at this German track, Lausitzring, I can't say it.
Lausitzring.
That's it.
Yeah.
And it's the half the track, it's mostly wet, but there's some dry patches, but it's a mostly wet track. And it's just Vettel and Hamilton for like four laps, overtaking each other side by side. And like, you see that Vettel back then when he was, like, I don't know, 16, 17. And you compare it now, like, it's so different. So yeah, that scares me. I do as much as I can not to stop that from happening. You know, training, hand-eye coordination stuff, sim, karting, just being in the seat of a racing car. Yeah. It's still my only passion is racing, being a professional driver. So
excellent. Well, yeah, that's three excellent answers, and particularly like your Bitcoin one. But Jan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We obviously wish you all the best for the future. Hope to see you back in Japan racing out there. If anyone wants to follow Jan, you can do so on his socials, Jan the Man, his website, jantheman.com, and Jan's blog, which is definitely worth a read. I've started having a little nose into that. Some good stuff appearing there. So, Jan, best of luck with the future. Hopefully see you at our karting day. If not, we'll see you in a paddock soon. Thanks for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you, Tim. Cheers, Harry.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the sport. Official ticket packages, which include the best race tickets, first class hotels, travel and exclusive behind the scenes access across a Grand Prix weekend. F1 Experiences offer packages like no other. So to book your F1 Experiences package, head online to f1experiences.com, and if you enter code Motormouth, you'll get 5% off too. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review, and until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.